what we learned investigating the death of Chicano student activist Oscar Gomez.
It sounds like you ran almost every theory to its end.
Binge all 8 episodes of Imperfect Paradise, The Forgotten Revolutionary, wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning. I'm Larry Mantle. We're with you an hour early leading up to NPR's live gavel-to-gavel coverage of the Senate impeachment trial. Their coverage starts at 10. We'll start our hour with 2 big entertainment-related stories. The Recording Academy's in an uproar over its removal of Deborah Dugan as CEO. She'd been in the position less than a year. The Academy said she'd been accused of bullying by one of her staff members. Dugan's responded with a discrimination complaint against the organization. This all with the Grammy Awards scheduled to be given out Sunday night. Meanwhile, opening arguments underway today in former movie producer Harvey Weinstein's rape trial in New York. That and more coming up after the news.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. We're coming your way an hour earlier than typical so we can bring you live NPR gavel-to-gavel coverage of the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump. That comes underway at 10 o'clock and probably will go rather late, just as last night's did into the 11 o'clock hour. We have a lot to talk about in this hour of Air Talk, entertainment-related stories to begin, and then KPCC political reporter Libby Denkman has been on top of a story that's fascinating. It's about the election systems in Los Angeles County, the hardware that's going to be part of it, the election centers which are debuting for people to vote over a period of days. So she's going to talk with us about the enterprise reporting that she's done on that. And then we'll preview day 2 of the impeachment trials. We take you up to NPR. We begin with the Recording Academy, where things are in an uproar. The CEO of the organization was put on leave and an investigation launched into allegations that she engaged in bullying behavior toward a staff member who had filed a complaint. Well, her legal team responded today with allegations of discrimination and sexual harassment in a filing with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Joining us to talk about all this just days ahead of Sunday night's Grammy Awards is Jem Aswad, who's senior music writer for Variety. Jem, good to have you with us.
Good morning.
So this has blown up into a mess for the Academy. So take us back, first of all, to the suspension or whatever you'd call it while this investigation is taking place. Was there just one allegation against the now on leave CEO, Deborah Dugan?
Well, there are sort of two things going on there. The specific allegation against her, and she was placed on administrative leave. She has not been fired, although it's almost impossible to imagine her coming back. The specific allegation was that she of misconduct against a senior female employee on the Academy staff. That person is widely believed to be her assistant, who had been the assistant of her predecessor. Now, the things at the Academy have been in a bit of an uproar over the last 2 years, ever since Neil Portnow, the former head of the Academy, said that female executives and musicians needed to step up in order to be recognized. Now, he misspoke when he said that, but it did expose the diversity problems that the Academy has had. So there are politics at play there, but the generally accepted view is that They're using an allegation of misconduct. They say that she was verbally abusive or something like that to this person. But what it really is she was number one, not a great fit for the Academy's culture. Apparently, she came in with a mandate to make dramatic changes, but the Academy is very established and the power there is very entrenched. And even though the former CEO had stepped down, the forces that made the Academy into the way it is are still there, and they're fighting back against Deborah Dugan, the one who's been placed on administrative leave. They're fighting back very aggressively. There's more drama to come today, that's for sure.
Well, and I think the bigger issue for the general public, beyond the alleged behavior of people within the Grammy organization, the Recording Academy, is her allegation that once the membership of the Grammys come up with their slate of potential nominees in a category, that then the committees that whittle that number down to the formal nominees is rife with self-interest dealing, with people that are even up for nominations being, you know, part of the decision makers in that process, and that essentially she's alleging that's a corrupt project, process. That's a big deal.
That is an enormous deal, and that's what takes this out of inside baseball, quite frankly, because there's a specific allegation in there that an artist, I can't remember the calculus they used exactly, but there's an artist who placed pretty far down the shortlist for the nominees, was elevated to the top and was nominated over Ariana Grande and Ed Sheeran. Now, that would probably be a pop category. We could probably figure out who it was. I don't really want to go there. But
yeah, you'd hate to undermine someone who may have very legitimately been the nominee.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, but if I were an artist who, you know, and I were reading that and I were one of those artists, I'd be enraged. You know, I mean, because what that basically says is that these people lost a nomination to politics, you know, in music industry politics. And sure, things like that happen all the time, you know, and you can also say that just because someone is, you know, working with an artist or related to an artist or something like that, that does not that doesn't mean that person isn't a legitimate candidate, you know, or talented or anything like that. But it certainly is messy.
Well, and I'm sure that the Academy has the problem that many sort of specialty organizations do, because the people who are often most knowledgeable about particular categories of music have worked with a wide number of people under consideration for honors in those categories. That sort of incestuousness, that's sort of built into this, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's built into most businesses and you know, relationships in the world in a lot of ways. It's a very fine line to draw, you know, but you would think that after, what's it been, 62 years, that there would be safeguards in place where, you know, there were clear guidelines about it, and I'm not sure that there are.
We're talking with Jem Aswad, who is senior music editor for Variety. We're talking with him about the huge uproar at the Grammys with charges and countercharges. It's an employment issue, but of course involving a major cultural organization. Also with us, Angela Reddock Wright, employment attorney, mediator, and workplace investigator. She's managing attorney of the LA firm Reddock Law Group. Ms. Reddock Wright, thank you very much for being with us. Obviously, we got different investigations, potentially an EEOC governmental one. The Academy had announced it has two different third-party investigations. So how is this likely to play out?
Thank you, Larry. So the EEOC investigation, that is a requirement that you file an administrative claim either with the EEOC, which is a federal agency. It's called the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, a federal government agency, or with the equivalent of your state administrative agency. And so in New York, it would be the New York Employment Housing Commission, most likely. So Ms. Dugan chose to file with the EEOC. they will receive her complaint, and then she has the option as the complainant to either request that they investigate the complaint or to request an immediate right to sue letter. If they investigate, then they will interview her. They will interview other witnesses that may have knowledge of her claims, which, by the way, I believe her claims are most likely for discrimination, harassment, and possibly retaliation, that when she came forward to make these complaints about the practices, the behind-the-scenes practices, that she was retaliated against by being placed on administrative leave.
And are there whistleblower statutes that apply in the case of a CEO that is attempting to have, what she's alleging of bad behavior dealt with? Or is that not a factor here?
Yeah, look, a retaliation claim is the equivalent of a whistleblower action in a private employer situation such as this. So certainly she has, whistleblower status in coming forward. But they're likely to interview witnesses and as a part of an investigation and then make a finding as to whether they believe her claims are substantiated anyway or if there's any merit to her claims. If she opts for an immediate right to sue letter, that empowers her and her attorneys to immediately to go to a civil court and file a complaint alleging her claims, whatever they may be, discrimination, harassment, retaliation. So we're still waiting to see if she's going to request an immediate right to sue letter or request a simultaneous investigation to the two third-party investigations that are happening internally at the Grammy.
In a case like this, do these usually settle, or the fact that the allegations so quickly went from 0 to 60 and became public, is it now less likely that's going to happen?
I think at some point the matter will settle just because there's a lot at stake both for her. The Grammys are also alleging that she engaged in improper conduct, which is why they're having a separate investigation done. And then obviously she has claims against the Grammy organization, which I presume that they don't want to get out either. So I think at some point the case is likely to settle just because there's so much at stake and so much information that could come out that would be damaging both to Ms. Dugan as well as to the Grammys organization. So I think both parties have motivation to ultimately settle. When that happens, we don't know yet, but I suspect that that will be somewhere down the road.
We're talking with employment specialist attorney Angela Reddock Wright of Los Angeles. Also with us, former prosecutor Ambrosio Rodriguez, currently criminal defense attorney at the Rodriguez Law Group in Los Angeles, and he led the sex crimes prosecution team in the Riverside County District's Attorney's Office. He's with us to talk about a separate legal matter, but entertainment related, as former producer Harvey Weinstein, the opening statements are scheduled to get underway in his New York City rape trial today. Ambrosio, it's good to have you with us. This is the start of a much anticipated trial. What are some of the most important aspects of this trial over the weeks to come?
Well, look, I think this trial is going to be a blockbuster in terms of the amount of fighting between the prosecution and the defense and the aggressiveness from both sides. I think that there are a couple of major issues in this case. The first one is that the biggest hurdle that the Weinstein defense has to overcome, their biggest hurdle, is the fact that there are multiple victims. And in sexual assault cases, when you have multiple victims, women that don't know each other, all making similar accusations, that's a hard thing to overcome. But for the prosecution, I think one of the things that they have to deal with and try to explain to the jurors in order to get a conviction is the fact that, as reported in the New York Times today, the defense has multiple emails of these alleged victims maintaining a relationship with Harvey Weinstein after the alleged sexual assault. And I think that's very hard for people to get their heads around. I think it's very hard to prove that a woman was sexually assaulted, yet continued to keep a relationship with her, rapist. This isn't a situation where we're talking about a child in a sexual molestation case where the alleged, the person accused of committing sex crimes has a parental or custodial control over the child. We're talking about adults. And so how credible is it that to say that I was raped by this man, but I maintain a relationship and I send him all these nice emails and I ask him to come meet my mother.
Now, the judge, as I understand it, Ambrosio, is not allowing the full text of those emails to be read into court. What would be the reason for that, if that might go to the defense's claim that these were consensual encounters?
Well, the judge allowed the defense to talk about it during opening statement, but not to show them during opening statement. And a lot of evidentiary rulings happen at the time either side seeks to introduce certain evidence. And when one witness says something, it might cause evidence that wasn't once allowed to come in. So there's a lot of things that are going to happen very quickly, and it just depends on what the witnesses say. Because if the witness says, yes, I sent those emails, then there's nothing to impeach her with. So kind of not to kind of get into the weeds of the law, but like I said, this is going to be, and from what I read, these are two very accomplished attorneys, and it is going to be a long battle. And, you know, I think listeners should also keep in mind that it's not one or the other. It's not guilty or not guilty. It can also be a mixed verdict. It can be a hung jury. The biggest charge, obviously, that the defense is going after is the one that carries life in prison.
We'll
see what happens.
Ambrosio, in the Bill Cosby prosecution's first time, there was the hung jury, and then the second trial, as I recall, and correct me if my memory's bad, but then you had multiple women making allegations of very similar assaults by Cosby as a part of the prosecution case against him. That was allowed in. In this case, I believe there are going to be women who are not party to this actual prosecution, but who will be able to testify alleging that he had done similar things with them to what is alleged in the rape prosecution. And I'm just curious, when did this start getting introduced into cases? Is it a fairly recent phenomenon? Because obviously these are cases for which no trial was held. You have someone who is attesting to a similar pattern, but there's been nothing adjudicated as to the claim of those other incidents.
Right. These are called prior bad acts, and this has been going on. This has been the law in California for at least 25 years. As long as I've been an attorney, this has been part of the judicial system. And it's used both in sexual assault cases and domestic violence cases and family violence cases to show a pattern. And when the DA brings in other alleged victims to, you know, when the crimes aren't charged, right, to establish a pattern, the DA doesn't even have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that these other accusations happened. They just have to be proved by a preponderance of the evidence or other evidentiary hurdles, but not beyond a reasonable doubt, in order to establish a pattern. And the reason that that's allowed is because, as in the Weinstein case and in the overwhelming majority, and I'm talking in the 90% plus, there's usually never physical evidence. So it depends on the credibility of the witness. And in order to buttress, to support the credibility of the witness, the law allows prosecutors to bring in other witnesses that say, even though the crime isn't charged, to say, hey, he did the same thing to me. This is what happened to me.
Also with us again, Attorney Angela Reddock-Wright. Angela, it seems that, you know, this is a big challenge for the defense, as it was in the Cosby case. If you're going to have multiple women alleging there is a standard operating method, abusive method that Weinstein used, and they all have similar accounts.
Yes, and I hear what the DA is saying, or the former prosecutor is stating. I think that what the defense can argue is that, or what the prosecution can argue is that, although these women continue to communicate with Weinstein, that they were communicating with him because they wanted to work in Hollywood, and he was the doorkeeper to Hollywood. So although they had previously bad experiences with him, have been assaulted by him, that they felt a need to stay in touch in order to be able to move forward in the industry. He had just that much power in Hollywood that you had to go through Weinstein to do anything. So they essentially were left with no option. That's certainly the argument I would make.
All right. I want to thank you both so much for being with us. That's Angela Radok-Wright, who is an attorney, mediator, and workplace investigator based in Los Angeles. Ambrosio Rodriguez, who is a criminal defense attorney and who headed the sex crimes team in the Riverside County District Attorney's Office prior to going into practice for himself as a defense attorney. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3. Back in just one moment. We'll be talking with Libby Denkman, KPECC politics reporter, and she has a lot to say about the upcoming election. Back in 1 minute.
Support comes from Japan House LA presenting Yes, Kawaii is Art. Express yourself. Kawaii translates to cute or adorable, yet its influence extends beyond aesthetics to encompass fashion, art, technology, and even social behavior. Sebastian Masuda, the king of kawaii, brings together multiple artworks unraveling the kawaii concepts to foster a sense of joy, innocence, and community as a tool for self-expression and representation. Visitors can step into this colorful world to feel the aesthetic for themselves. May 2nd to November 3rd. No admissions fee. More at japanhousela.com.
Nothing wrong with your clock. We're coming your way an hour early on Air Talk today because NPR's live gavel-to-gavel coverage of the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump is coming up at 10 o'clock. We'll have that for you right here on KPECC. I'm joined now by KPECC politics reporter Libby Denkman. If you've been reading her work on LAist.com or hearing her reporting on KPECC, you know there are actually three Libbys. You've been multiple places at the same time.
Isn't
working.
That amazing how I
it
do that?
It is. I don't know. The cloning. I want to try that and lessen the workload. So let's talk first about the big changes that are coming to LA County elections with the voting centers, no more of your neighborhood precincts, and along with that, brand new voting hardware.
That's right. So there is this big change coming for the March 3rd primary, and it has to do with a law that was passed in 2016 called the Voters' Choice Act. And that basically allowed counties to opt into this new system. The idea was increasingly we're voting by mail, but also we would have a more useful kind of in-person voting experience so that when you walk into what are now called vote centers instead of polling places, you're going to have help in multiple languages. You're going to be able to pick up a replacement ballot if you want. You are going to have an accessible voting experience that's really based on something called human-centered design. So the voting centers are moving us from a system where we had 4,800 polling places in Los Angeles County. This change is also happening in Orange County, although the hardware is going to be different. So we'll talk about that in a bit. So from 4,800 polling places to just 1,000 vote centers. However, you can go to any vote center in the county. So Dean Logan, the registrar recorder, is really hot on how convenient this is going to be for people. The number one reason that people have to fill out a provisional ballot or have trouble when they walk in to vote is that they've gone to the wrong polling place. So that's going to be completely eliminated here under this new system. And the vote centers will be open for 10 days prior to the election. That's an 11-day voting period. So you can go on the weekend, you can go when it's convenient for you. So this idea the state law had and also the registrar recorder here in LA is that this is a more utilitarian, useful way, convenient way to vote.
It is more utilitarian. I can certainly see that. For myself, the only reason to vote in person was to do it in my neighborhood, to see my neighbors, to be in line with them, to have the conversation, you know, as we're ready to go, into the polling location.
Where did you go? Was it a school
it was a fire
or a church?
Station.
A fire station. Yeah. That's so cool.
Yeah, it was great. And they moved the trucks out to move the voting equipment in. So I just wonder, it is utilitarian, but kind of what's the point of going to a voting center? For the first time ever, I actually asked for vote by mail, because if I'm not going to have a neighborhood, why not just send it in? And I wonder how many people are actually going to use these voting centers.
Yeah, so Los Angeles County is a special case, even when it comes to the Voters' Choice Act. We've done some reporting on this about people feeling nostalgic for their neighborhood polling places. I go to a church down the street. I love going to that church, seeing, you know, the people that volunteer
workers.
Every. Yep. So Los Angeles County got this one-time carve-out in the Voters' Choice Act, which is that every other county that implements it, this vote center model, will have to also mail a ballot to everyone in the county. So Orange County, for example, moving to the vote center model, also closing its neighborhood polling places. But the registrar there, Neil Kelly, has to mail out a vote-by-mail ballot to everyone. Now, the argument in L.A. is that we vote in person at just such a higher rate than the rest of the state. Statewide, we vote by mail by about two-thirds rate. Two-thirds of voters use that option. In L.A. County in 2018, it was about 45%. So we are just a county that is much more focused on going in and going in person. And maybe that's personal preference. Maybe that's just people don't get, you know, ahead of time registered to get a vote by mail ballot. But that's the difference between us and the rest of the state. And it remains to be seen if a lot more people sign up for the vote by mail option this time around.
Yeah. And there'll be new hardware. So reading your reporting of this, absolutely fascinating that L.A. County has developed its own system. Actually contracted to have the devices built by a company according to LA County specs, not using a vendor that specifically makes these kinds of machines.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. Dean Logan, about 10 years ago, the registrar recorder in LA, identified this problem with the voting industry, which is it's really controlled by three private companies. Much of their technology is proprietary. It's hard for public entities to get information and encourage them to change the equipment that's used at polling places. So about 10 years ago, he launched this project to create an open source publicly owned voting system. It would be a first for California. It's a very rare thing to try. And he really, you know, brought in the community. There's been thousands of voters interviewed, design panels and engineers, security experts, everybody sort of doing input on this project. And it's resulted in a top to bottom new machine. It's called a ballot marking device that's going to be used for every voter who votes in person in LA County. That ballot marking device means that you walk in, you get a ballot printed for yourself that's based on your precinct. Any vote center can do this for you in the county. You walk up to a machine that looks like an iPad in a plastic table. It can be adjusted up and down if you have mobility issues. And it has these tactile buttons on the side and headphones. And you're going to feed that ballot, your ballot, into the machine. You'll make your selections on the touchscreen. And then at the end, you'll print that ballot out. So you'll have a paper ballot in your hand to check before casting it, feeding it back into the machine for a final vote cast. So that's a brand new system. Every voter who votes in person will be using those machines. And it's really a huge shift from the old IncaVote system.
You detailed in your reporting a number of issues, one of which, though, I think is particularly concerning, and that is that only four candidates at a time can be displayed on the screen, requiring of the voter, and we know voters make a lot of mistakes, to actually toggle the names up to get the full number of candidates right for the races.
Right.
As opposed to, you know, putting them all on a screen, even in small print, and allowing the person to be able to focus then in on names to at least see that there are more there initially. It doesn't do that.
Yeah.
And Beverly Hills, you reported, is considering filing a suit against this.
Yeah, I spoke with the Beverly Hills city attorney yesterday, and he says he's drafting it. They're going ahead with this lawsuit. He says that he thinks that this is a huge issue for candidates who are listed lower down on the ballot after the fourth candidate, because the more button, despite the fact that LA County has really done a lot of work since some mock elections last fall and also a pilot program where these machines were in use in November to increase the visibility of the more button, which allows you to toggle down to see the rest of the candidates. They also added this gradient function at the end of the digital ballot's first page so that you can see there's more to go on the ballot until you reach the bottom. However, in a primary, as the Beverly Hills City candidates and also their attorney argue, has a ton of candidates on the ballot. And the fear is that it's too easy to hit a next or skip button, go ahead, never see the other candidates, and entirely miss some potential choices for voters.
And I assume the order of the candidates will not be scrambled so that different people will see a different order of candidates?
So statewide, candidates are rotated based on assembly district, and local candidates like a city council election are not. So those are based on the Secretary of State's random alphabet drawing that has been determined in December. And so when we're talking about, you know, congressional candidates, statewide races will be rotated. However, these local races are not going to be in. Several cities are upset about this. I want to say, though, Dean Logan is pushing back. He says that in the pilot election in Long Beach's city council district races, that he was able to compare these paper ballots that people mailed in to the hand-marked ballots in the voting centers and the ballot marking devices. And he says there was no significant difference between those. So that he believes that the changes they've made to make that more button visible are enough to make the ballot digitally show up in a fair way.
We invited Dean Logan, L.A. County Registrar Recorder, to join us today, and we've not heard back from him. We look forward to having him on before the election. We're talking with Libby Dankman, KPECC politics reporter. At what point are people going to be able to access where their voting centers are? I tried to find mine. I couldn't find it.
Right. So in Orange County, those have been released. Neil Kelly announced those last week, and I tweeted those out, and we'll also have those linked on LAist.com. We're going to have a huge voter game plan build out for everybody's voting needs. We're still waiting for all the finalized locations in Los Angeles. One of the issues that I've heard from elections officials is to keep a voting center open for 11 days, to have the equipment and everything that it takes for an 11-day voting period, it's hard to find those locations,
including
parking, all the accessibility issues in the areas that they're needed to make sure there's a level of equity across the county.
Well, and this problem they knew from the beginning. I mean, we talked about this even with the state legislation creating these voting centers. This was going to be the toughest challenge, is how do you find the locations that have the right size, the right infrastructure, the accessibility issues for an 11-day period of time, plus the setup and teardown.
Sure, but you know, when you think about neighborhood polling places, we've had issues in the past where volunteers who are very well-intentioned arrive, they don't really know how to set up the equipment, there's irregularities in the way that those neighborhood polling places are administered. You hear maybe incorrect information about casting provisional ballots or what have you. So, idea of having a more professionalized, centralized way to vote is something that Dean Logan and his team are really excited about.
And we'll see how it plays out. I think it's fair to expect some rough edges for this primary election.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean it'll blast. You know,
sure,
they'll be able to work out the kinks.
And I want to point out the state certification process is still open at this point for the new machines. We are waiting to hear if Secretary of State Alex Padilla does certify the new ballot marking devices and the entire system. There's a potential that there could be more changes to come to these machines ahead of voting because the state has not officially signed off yet. The public comment period just closed on Monday.
We're just over a month away from
Larry,
the
don't
California
I
primary.
Know it.
All right.
It's coming up.
We had a lot more scheduled to talk about. Can you come back next week,
of
Libby,
course,
and talk? Because we have to talk about the big congressional race,
yep,
in Los Angeles County where Katie Hill resigned. Are Republicans going to be able to flip that back, or can Democrats hold on to it? We, of course, have L.A. City Council, Board of Supervisors, and more. So we'll talk with you
I'm
then.
I'm a busy reporter, Larry.
You are indeed. Libby Dankman, KPECC politics reporter. You can share your comments. comments on the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. And speaking of politics, day two of the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump, NPR coverage just about 21 minutes away right now. And from NPR, Ron Elving will be with us to walk us through the day's big events to come, back in 2 minutes on Air Talk.
Support comes from Ciclavia, catalyzing vibrant public spaces, active transportation, and good health through car-free streets. Ciclavia promotes respect and infrastructure for bike and pedestrian-friendly public spaces. Enjoy these pop-up parks for the day in your favorite people-powered way. Jogging, biking, skating, strolling, or simply spectating. Free and open to all, Ciclavia Sundays generate miles of smiles in neighborhoods all over L.A. Details at www.ciclavia.org.
So Libby and I just, like the politics nerds we are, just continued our conversation during the two-minute break. But we continue with politics here on Air Talk, the impeachment trial of President Trump in the U.S. Senate, day two. Last night it went past the 11 o'clock hour Pacific time. That, of course, around 2 in the morning, or I should say past 10 o'clock our time, past 1 o'clock in the morning on the East Coast. With us to talk about what happened, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR, Ron Elving. Ron, thank you so much for joining us. These are marathon days. And the rules set after yesterday, so what's going to happen today?
Today we hear from the House managers. We heard from them yesterday talking about the case a little bit in terms of the rule, but today they really start laying it out. So you've got seven individuals led by a couple of Californians, Adam Schiff, of course, a Democrat from California, and also Zoe Lofgren, a Democrat from California, who was around for the Clinton impeachment on the same House Judiciary Committee, defending President Clinton at that time. And also was around as a staff member for the House Judiciary Committee when Richard Nixon was impeached way back in 1974. She was a young staffer just out of law school. So at that at this time today, we really get going with the presentation of the case for removing the president from office.
All right. Yesterday, we had some late into the night fireworks. House impeachment manager Jerry Nadler accusing Senate Republicans of being complicit by voting to deny witnesses, saying it's a vote against an honest consideration of evidence.
So far, I'm sad to say, I see a lot of senators voting for a cover-up, voting to deny witnesses, an absolutely indefensible vote, obviously. A treacherous vote.
White House counsel Pat Cipollone fired back at Nadler, calling on the Democrat to apologize to President Trump, his family, and the American people.
Mr. Nadler came up here and made false allegations against our team. He made false allegations against all of you. He accused you of a cover-up. He's been making false allegations against the president. The only one who should be embarrassed, Mr. Nadler, is you.
And in those early morning hours, as the exchange got very personal, Chief Justice John Roberts, presiding over the impeachment trial, laid into both sides, although in a very justice-like way.
I think it is appropriate at this point for me to admonish both the House managers and the President's counsel in equal terms to remember that they are addressing the world's greatest deliberative body. One reason it has earned that title is because its members avoid speaking in a manner and using language that is not conducive to civil discourse.
Ron Elving, were you surprised that the Chief Justice went after both sides?
No, not at all. He is highly disinclined to go after just one side. So he is probably going to wait until one misbehavior is answered by another one from the other sector so that he can sound as even-handed about doing it as possible. He has famously used the umpire metaphor for what he is doing, and he wants to make sure that he's calling the same strike zone for both teams. And that's been something that he has indicated he planned to do, something that William Rehnquist did mostly in a passive sort of way when he presided over the Clinton impeachment trial in 1999. And, you know, one of the things that he is saying here, where he says the world's greatest deliberative body, that's not just his review of the Senate. I mean, that is a term that the Senate has embraced over the years for itself. It's a self-praising description of the United States Senate. And some people have parodied it by saying it's the world's most deliberate body. But it certainly is something the Senate likes to think of itself. So he's appealing to the better angels of their natures there. And also he is trying to dial back the personal, the use of names. That is, the Senate protocol, Senate custom folkway, is that you don't use anyone's name. It's the gentleman from Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And a lady from Texas, but you don't use their actual names.
And it was very pointed and personal, as you heard there last night. Ron, Republicans rebuffed Democrats' efforts to have witnesses called, that came into sharp relief last night with the exchanges over John Bolton, former national security advisor, who had said he would be willing to testify at the Senate trial if he was subpoenaed. There is an opportunity later after each side presents its arguments to call witnesses. Is there a thought that there are enough Republicans who are open to that, that it could still happen?
Open to that, yes. Willing to vote for it, maybe not. So we've had several who have said they're open to the idea. This morning it was Florida Republican Senator Rick Scott who said, well, I'm open to the idea of having witnesses. There's a big, long step between saying I'm open to the idea and being willing to cast a vote on the floor of the Senate under the watchful eye of Senate Leader Mitch McConnell, and also, of course, the watchful eye of President Trump, who is not going to want to have witnesses called, among other reasons, because it would elongate this trial and make it go into a third week. And if that happens, it's going to interfere with, or at least undercut, the drama of his State of the Union address, which is less than 2 weeks away on February 4th.
Ron, I heard you on Morning Edition. I know you were up till early in the morning watching what unfolded. How much sleep did you get last night?
Less than ideal.
I bet. Way less.
I got a few hours.
A few hours. Oh, okay, very good. Are you on today's NPR coverage we'll be hearing?
Yes, I am. I'm not on the early shift. I'll be coming on a little later on in the afternoon. And staying until the last dog is hung.
Okay, we'll get a nap, we hope. All right. Ron, thank you so much. Always appreciate it. Ron Elving, NPR, a senior editor, correspondent on the Washington desk. Coming up, we'll talk with legal scholars and hear what they have to say about yesterday's proceedings and what they think are the most important competing arguments that we'll hear on day two. We'll talk with William Banks and John Malcolm. Coming up, you're listening to Air Talk on KPECC. Back in 1 minute.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of the How to LA podcast. How about we go to the movies? Join us for a 10-part series, Revival House, and discover the magic of LA's indie theaters. Who knows? You might meet someone.
I know it sounds antithetical because you're just sitting passively, but in fact, you're connecting with everyone else around you.
Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Lead impeachment manager Adam Schiff is holding a news conference right now, just about 10 minutes before they get into the arguments. Wow. He has plenty of airtime today throughout the course of the trial, but he's already talking with reporters. We're previewing what's to come. NPR's live gavel-to-gavel coverage commences in about 10 minutes right here on 89.3 KPCC. Joining me from the Heritage Foundation, Director of the Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, Vice President of the Institute for Constitutional Government at Heritage, John Malcolm. Mr. Malcolm, good to have you back with us. What do we anticipate seeing today between the attorneys for the president and the managers from the House?
More political tempers flaring, I'm afraid. We are now underway, and the House managers are going to have up to 24 hours over three calendar days to make their case. It's a little unusual, of course, in that all the witnesses and documents that they will be arguing about, the public saw them testify or read deposition transcripts when they happened behind closed doors in the House Intelligence Committee. I don't think that there are going to be any great surprises about the arguments that the House managers are going to make. They previewed that during some of the statements that they made yesterday. They were supposed to be arguing about amendments, proposed amendments to the rules, but they certainly took that opportunity to make various opening statements. And so I think we're going to be hearing a lot of the arguments that have been bandied about on talk radio stations across the political aisle for the last several weeks. Now we are in the Senate, the well of the Senate, so it's a different venue and a more sobering experience.
I'm interested in your thoughts on what seemed to me a rather creative amendment proposed by Democrats that the Chief Justice John Roberts would be able to call witnesses if he thought it would illuminate any of the arguments that are made. I wasn't aware that that proposal was going to be made. What did you think of that?
Well, look, the Senate gets to set the rules. It's certainly a very bizarre rule. I mean, the Chief Justice is going to have frightfully little to do during this trial. He can rule on evidentiary issues, all subject. Every ruling that he makes is subject to being reconsidered and overruled by a majority of the senators. I mean, let's remember why the Chief Justice is there in the first place. So normally, impeachment proceedings of all sorts against civil officers, so federal judges and whatnot, the presiding officer is the vice president of the United States, who's there to cast a vote in case of ties. The only reason that the Chief Justice is there in this instance is because the framers of the Constitution considered it unseemly to have the vice president presiding over an impeachment trial of the president, because if the president were to be removed, he would become the president of the United States. So there was perceived to be a clear conflict of interest. And for that reason, the framers, and very sensibly so, chose to put the Chief Justice in charge of this proceeding. But other than keeping decorum, as he did yesterday between Jerry Nadler and Pat Cipollone, he doesn't have much of a substantive role to play. And it was an interesting gambit by Senator Schumer to try to increase the substantive role of the Chief Justice, but it went down.
We're talking with John Malcolm of the Heritage Foundation, the conservative think tank in D.C. Also with us, Professor Emeritus of Law at Syracuse University, William C. Banks, co-author of the recently published Constitutional Law, Structure and Rights in Our Federal System. Professor Banks, good to have you back with us on the program. What are you looking forward to hearing or considering here in the back and forth?
Well, I think I agree with John's summation of what happened yesterday and his preview of what's likely to happen today. There's a lot of bluster and there's repetition of many of the points that have been made for the last several weeks as the House made its case in impeachment. One of the things to bear in mind about the procedure in the Senate, of course, is that there's very little in the way of a legal roadmap. Constitution says simply that the Senate shall have the sole power to try an impeachment. And that in the instance, as John said, in the instance where the president is impeached, the Chief Justice shall have a role to preside. There are no rules. There are no evidentiary standards. There's no prescription for examination and cross-examination. The Senate can go the way it wants to go. So the debates here are clearly political in nature, and there's very little law to go on. The heart of the matter, of course, is going to be whether what the House found in its two articles of impeachment amounts to high crimes and misdemeanors, the language from the impeachment clause of the Constitution. And there, the two sides have gone back and forth, and I'm afraid some of the discussion has been pretty hyperbolic. There's some suggestion by the president's lawyers that impeachment has to be a statutory crime, something that's in the United States Code. And I think the framers were pretty clear that adopting the phrase high crimes and misdemeanors was intended by them to allow for impeachment if a president abused the powers of his office.
And otherwise, you think they would have used language very specific to the criminal code?
They could have. You know, the draft before the Committee on Detail swapped out language and put in this high crimes and misdemeanors, the draft of the clause said for him he could be impeached or impeachment could be for maladministration, a more generic term. The high crimes and misdemeanors comes from England, of course, and it's not a misdemeanor in the sense that you were caught speeding down the freeway in Los Angeles. It's a more historically loaded term that refers to abuses of public office by senior officials.
We're talking with William C. Banks, Professor Emeritus, Syracuse University School of Law, John Malcolm of the Heritage Foundation. If you have questions for our legal experts, you can ask them on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. You can also tweet at AirTalk or post on the AirTalk Facebook page. I'd be glad to pass on questions to our expert guests. Mr. Malcolm, do you think that after the admonishment by the Chief Justice yesterday that there's any chance the back and forth is going to be less personal today?
Well, each side gets to present its case. So unlike the back and forth of are you in favor of this amendment, are you opposed to this amendment, I expect that most of the talking is going to be done by the House managers. But look, I think the tempers are going to run high throughout this entire thing. This has been, I mean, look, we had a complete breakdown in the sense that at least the vote, regardless of whether you think you're in favor of impeaching the president or opposed to impeaching the president, the breakdown has been exclusively along party lines. There were a couple of House Democrats that voted against the resolutions of impeachment. One of them has now transferred parties. So the two sides of the political aisle view this entire endeavor through radically different lenses, and the stakes are extremely high. I don't foresee any way that at the end of this process the president is actually going to be removed, but that's because I don't think they're ever going to get to the magic number of 67. But the stakes are quite high, not only in terms of this endeavor, the entire impeachment trial itself, but of course a lot of this also plays into the election in 2020.
John Malcolm of the Heritage Foundation, what do you think, just briefly, Professor Banks, bringing up President Trump's legal team saying this doesn't really fit impeachment because they're not criminal offenses alleged? Do you agree with the president's legal team or not, just briefly?
No, I think, you know, widespread across the spectrum, legal scholars view abuse of power, abuse of the office of the presidency as a permissible ground for impeachment. It was certainly a ground that would have brought President Nixon down had he not resigned in time. And, you know, I think historically the cases of impeachment have involved abuses of a power rather than statutory crimes.
All right. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Our legal experts, William C. Banks, Syracuse University, John Malcolm, the Heritage Foundation, and its Institute for Constitutional Government. Coming right up, NPR Live gavel-to-gavel coverage of the U.S. Senate impeachment trial of President Trump. It's expected to be hours long throughout the course of the day. NPR will provide analysis as we go. I'm hopeful that we'll be back with you tomorrow morning. We'll see what the new schedule for Thursday brings. Have a good day.
I'm Julia Paskin, host of Weekend Edition. Join me as I talk with NPR's Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. She's not alone in leaving the church. She's found she's among a rising generation fleeing the fold. That's April 25th at the Crawford in Pasadena. Tickets at laist.com/events.